Welcome to the Science Update Podcast. I'm Bob Hirshon, and this is the podcast for December 26, 2008. This week, we've got some stories about the human condition for you to contemplate as the year draws to a close. For instance, the surprising effect being clean has on our moral judgments, and why the placebo effect only works if you have the right genes. But first, Suzanne's going to go inside the brains of master impressionists to find out how they tick.
Good evening, my fellow Americans. I was so excited when I was told Senator Clinton and I would be addressing you tonight.
Comedian Tina Fey was recently in the spotlight for her nearly flawless impersonation of Republican vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin.
Well, Alaska and Russia are only separated by a narrow maritime border. You've got Alaska here, and this right here is water, and then that's up there's Russia. So we keep an eye on them.
Seeing that performance made me wonder about what makes impressionists like her so good at what they do. So I spoke with a researcher this week about what sets the professionals apart from us average people. Sophie Scott of University College London compared the brain activity of professional impressionists with that of mere mortals. She says the amateurs use just the speech area of their brains while attempting to vocally impersonate famous people. But the professionals also used an area of their brain responsible for visual imagery.
One of the things we find in the professional impressionist, as I say, is the interparietal sulcus, and that seems to relate to visual imagery. We also find areas in motor cortex, which are more activated when professionals are doing impressions than when they're speaking in their normal voice. And interestingly, this is motor cortex that's physically higher up in the brain than the parts of motor cortex that you use to move your articulators, that you move to speak. So they are activating a little bit the motor areas they would use to move their arms and their body and their faces, so they're not overtly moving. They're thinking about moving their arms, they're thinking about moving their faces.
Scott says using these areas of the brain allows them to visualize what a famous person looks like and how they move, and then reproduce this in their own body.
They don't sort of think of the sound and then try and match it. They really seem to drive their speech production system in really quite a physical way by addressing aspects about how the whole body moves.
One of Scott's collaborators was British impressionist Duncan Wisby. He describes this process while impersonating first Paul McCartney and then Michael Caine.
If you start off as a Paul McCartney, which involves the eyes being quite wide, like a barn owl, because you've got big eyes and a little beak, and I'm actively making a small round mouth and protruding my lower lip to get that kind of Paul McCartney sound, and then drop the accent. I leave the mouth where it is, and I push the effort of the voice towards the back of the throat, and then I'm flaring my nostrils a bit, and I'm closing my eyes. And I'm getting towards the sort of sound that you would need to make if you wanted to impersonate someone like Michael Caine.
Thanks, Suzanne. Next, would you break the law just because someone else did too? Turns out that many people will. Social scientist Kees Keyser of the University of Groningen in the Netherlands ran experiments on unsuspecting people. His team discovered that people were almost twice as likely to litter in an alley that was full of graffiti compared to a clean one. And they were also about twice as likely to steal an envelope full of money from a mailbox if there was graffiti on the box.
To our amazement, I must say, we expected an effect, but there were people I least expected to take the envelope.
Keyser says this shows that when rule-breaking behavior becomes common, it leads to more and different rule-breaking behavior. That's something to consider the next time you're tempted to litter. Well, speaking of questionable judgment, Suzanne has another story about how your circumstances can blur your sense of morality.
On a previous show, we told you about a study showing that when people think about ethically questionable acts, they're more likely to go wash their hands afterwards. Well, apparently, the converse may also be true. A new study suggests that people who have just washed their hands are less likely to judge ethically questionable acts as immoral. These are things like Bob mentioned, littering, stealing money, or, say, lying on your resume. Psychologist Simona Schnall of the University of Plymouth in England led the study. She and her colleagues had people watch an unpleasant toilet scene from a movie.
So everybody was made to feel disgusted by watching that film clip. And then half of the participants were given the opportunity to wash their hands after watching the film clip. And then all the participants answered some questions about how wrong it is to not return a lost wallet, how wrong it is to falsify information on one's CV, and so on, and various other kind of moral transgressions. And we find that those participants who had been given a chance to wash their hands after feeling disgusted, they said that the moral transgressions were less bad than those participants who presumably were still feeling disgusted after watching the film clip. So in other words, if you were in some way able to wash off the disgust you were feeling based on the film, you would prevent that disgust from influencing your judgment on how wrong a certain moral action was. So basically, if you feel disgusted, then you kind of transfer that feeling of disgust onto the judgment you're making, and it's as if you're saying, oh, that's disgusting. It's disgusting to do this. Whereas with the cleanliness, it's as if once you feel clean, you wash your hands, everything is clean, then you think, oh, it's not so bad. So the whole idea is about kind of mistaking whatever you're feeling at the moment to be relevant to the judgment that you're making, and therefore being led astray in one direction or another.
This suggests that our moral judgments are less rational than we might like to think, and more based on how we feel at a given moment. Schnall also says we may be hardwired to equate being clean with being moral to avoid illness.
We think that on some level, disgust evolved as a very basic emotion to avoid contamination based on food and various substances. To basically, you want to make sure you keep away potentially harmful substances, contaminants, so that you don't get sick. And on some level, it seems like this kind of physical sense of disgust also then spilled over into the moral domain, in the sense that we feel immoral things are disgusting and that we want to keep bad people or bad actions away from us, and we want to kind of maintain this purity of the body and the mind. So of the body when it comes to disgust and of the mind when it comes to morality.
Thanks for that report, Suzanne. I'm just trying to get the images of the toilet scenes out of my head. Okay, moving right along. In medicine, placebos or dummy pills can sometimes have just as strong an effect on patients as real drugs do. But some people don't respond to placebos at all. Our New York correspondent Justin Warner has a story about how, for the first time, scientists have linked a specific gene variant to the placebo effect, at least in one situation.
Some people are genetically predisposed to certain diseases, from cancer to depression. Your genes may also influence how well you respond to a particular drug. But can your genes affect your response to a plain old sugar pill? A report in the Journal of Neuroscience suggests they can. Psychologist Thomas Furmark of the University of Uppsala in Sweden is the lead author of the study. He says it started out as a trial of a new drug for social anxiety disorder. Standard procedure requires giving some subjects a placebo to see if the real drug works. Furmark says 40% of the placebo group got better after 8 weeks of the sham treatment.
The clinical effect was as evident as it was in groups that were treated with active drugs. And about 60% of the subjects did not respond at all to the placebo.
When they looked closer, the researchers found the two groups had different forms of a gene that controls a brain chemical called serotonin, which plays a key role in regulating mood. And over the course of the treatment, patients who responded well to the placebo showed a greater reduction in activity in a part of the brain called the amygdala, a center for fear and anxiety.
And that has actually been found in other studies as well, that these gene variants can indeed modulate, they can affect the activity in the amygdala.
But theirs is the first study to link these or any gene variants to a difference in the placebo effect. It's still not known exactly how these genes affect serotonin regulation and how those differences in serotonin regulation affect activity in the amygdala. Furmark says it also remains to be seen whether these particular genes would affect the response to other fake drugs.
Thanks, Justin. Well, that's our show for this week. Next week, we'll welcome in the new year by catching up on what's new in technology. We'll tell you how we may soon be charging our mobile phones with energy from our own bodies, and why hands-free mobile devices aren't as safe as many people think. And we'll answer a listener's question about global warming. Don't forget, we love to answer your science questions on our podcast, so give us a call at 1-800-WHY-IS-IT. Or go to our website at scienceupdate.com and email us a question. Until then, check out our Science Update Podcast Daily Edition. We've got a cutting-edge new science story every day, Monday through Friday. You can find it on our website or at iTunes. Thanks for listening. I'm Bob Hirshon for AAAS, the Science Society.